approval to break away. Did they receive Washington?
No. So therefore, they did not comply with the fourth article, and thus they were what? Illegal. And more than a little more than illegal. Let's think of it from this perspective. They're not only illegal, but they're engaging in illegality. Tearing up the Union, tearing up the country. Wouldn't that fall kind of in the realms of treason? Well, when it comes to the West Virginia part, I'm still attacking the Confederacy right now. I want to get my jollies out of that before we move to West Virginia. And so if it's, someone might say, well, we did the same to Britain, right? We declared independence from Britain, and there technically we were involved in treason also. What was the purpose in the 1770s for breaking away from Britain? Yeah, to avoid paying taxes. What was the purpose of breaking away from the North? That's exactly right on. Even if it's fictional somewhere out in the Western Territory, it is essentially to protect the right to enslave people. So which one do you think is more honorable as a form of treason? I think not paying taxes has a lot more honor to it. So what I'm getting at is the celebration of the Confederacy is the celebration of people who committed treasonable acts to enslave people. Is that something you'd name a high school mascot for? I hope not. So they're illegal and unethical, I think. West Virginia, its purpose to break away from Virginia was to what? To not be associated with the insurance of slavery. Or, I think, to be more practical, save the bus. Because they're sitting on the line where it's kind of like back during the Cold War, Germany and Austria in that area, they were the ones who had the most to lose if Russian and American missiles flew. And I think what they were thinking was that the area of Tennessee and Kentucky and West Virginia, that was the area that was feared to be where the battle sites would be the most. So not to doubt their commitment to freedom, but I'm thinking that they may well have reasoned out that the South's going to lose this, the North's going to win. And therefore, it's in our best interest to break away and rejoin the North. However, if you go technically by the law, while Congress may have approved them as a state in 1863, Virginia never did, never has. So if they never received the consent of their own state's legislature to become a separate state, they're not legal yet, unless you consider, well, Virginia didn't have the right to vote anymore because they had left. If you do that, then you take the opinion that they had the right to leave. So what ought to be is, I think technically Virginia should vote on it. Virginia should be told they better vote on approving. Make it all easy and illegal. But other states don't try that stuff. Which wasn't your question, but it was the answer I wanted to try to give. Now you're going to get like my wife and say, don't dare ask a question. He talks forever on each one. Well, so we're back to this. So in the 1890s, two phenomena occur, and that is the emergence of Jim Crow laws, and the other is the disfranchisement of black voters. So here I'd said it was useful and convenient for African Americans to be voting, and then southern states began to disenfranchise these voters, and they passed these laws. And the Jim Crow laws, as we said last time, are those that forcefully segregate the races in public places. So the question should arise, why, if there was a certain degree of peace and harmony and a voting right continuing for the first 15 years after Reconstruction, in the 90s do these things change? And I give these three reasons here in number 9 for it. And probably the first two are very, very debatable. When I built this lecture long ago, I just believed where I grabbed my material. But in time I began to think this is real controversial and very spiritual. So I went back and started examining to what degree is this true, or is this some historian who's you know, hijacked the community and got everybody believing his direction. It's pretty accurate. The second one is more true after the turn of the 20th century. But it's pretty accurate that all three of these are contributing factors to number 8. The first one, as we mentioned before, was this appearance of an idea that certain, not just white people, but certain white people among white people are superior. From a Darwinistic perspective, that's that Teutonic race cult notion we talked about. And so if that creates a certain anthropological justified racism in Europe and in universities in the northeast of America, it's surely going to give a feeling of justification for racism in the South and for increased racism in the South, which will come about from these other factors. Second one I mentioned was the impact of the writings, thinkings, and teachings of W.E.B. Du Bois and how he contrasted with that of Booker T. Washington. And that's what we're looking at in 11 and 12. Let's go back and talk somewhat about Washington. Washington, who was the most popular community leader throughout the end of the 19th century, throughout the Gilded Age and into the early couple of decades of the 20th century, taught a theory that the best way for the black community to survive and to prosper was to not directly confront white society for equality, to be willing to accept vocational work, gradually generation by generation gain property, and then eventually after achieving and receiving acceptance in the white community, then seeking higher levels of professions. The belief was that there's not going to be any opportunities provided or any acceptance given until there is enough financial voice that they become to be respected and accepted in that regard. And that wouldn't happen for at least three generations, he believed. Now, there are those who say that's a wise, practical, and safe measure, and there's others that say that is the formula for permanent second-class citizenship. There'll always be an excuse to wait and transfer. And that's how Du Bois, one of his disciples, felt. He started off being a devoted follower of Booker T. Washington. But his own experience was one that, after earning a degree at Fisk University, a bachelor's degree, then going to Harvard, not having that degree honored, he earned a second bachelor's degree at Harvard, and eventually a PhD from Harvard. And with all of this work, he came to realize that given the opportunity, he didn't have to wait two or three generations, and no one should have to. And he reasoned out that if some 30, 40 years prior to this, three constitutional amendments in a war occurred to overcome slavery and the effects of slavery, then it shouldn't still be a century later for people to receive equality. So he began to disagree with Washington. This is especially true after Washington gave a speech at number 11 in Atlanta at a state fair in which he was given a chance to be a headline speaker. And Washington outlined and enunciated this idea of gradualism, this idea of not confronting white society. Very pleasing to white ears that were listening, very disappointing to people like Du Bois, who called it a compromise and a sellout. And so from 1896 onward, that's when we start to see Du Bois be more outspoken in his opposition to Washington and more demanding of the right of immediate enfranchisement of African Americans. So why would this contribute to changing climate in the South? What's the feeling here? For that matter, Du Bois was hardly known among most people in the South. So is it reasonable to link his writings and thinkings into this backlash? It is in the sense that what were the rumblings and the speakings and the thinkings among African Americans? And there, even if it was just a matter of attitude change, that was perceived. I was trying to find a parallel. It's not a good parallel, and I'll probably get some backlash myself here. But I was thinking about when the Massachusetts State Supreme Court and Gavin Newsom did what they did about 2 years ago, I guess. But what do they have in common? Who's Gavin Newsom? If I have his name right, I think I do. The mayor of San Francisco. Now that ought to clue it. He started granting marriage licenses, and the state of Massachusetts Supreme Court passed a ruling that said that to deny marriages denies the equality of gay people, and that the Massachusetts legislature is expected and obligated to pass legislation guaranteeing protection of that. What was the reaction nationally to that? Pardon? Very much so. In what some orders, some examples we saw, besides just complaints and criticism? Constitutional amendments in about 12 states. I think they all passed. Now, there were no proposals for constitutional amendments to ban gay marriage until this. So, and it was a lot of people say Kerry lost the election on that issue, more so than the war as well. Not that he was for it or against it, but the party was associated with that. So if you look practically speaking on that issue, a year or two after Newsom and the Massachusetts State Supreme Court had taken their actions, where is Where is that issue? Yeah, it's backwards. It's now it's outlawed in areas where it wasn't even an issue. So would you say that what the state Supreme Court and Gavin Newsom did hurt the cause? So I'm trying to draw the parallel and say, did Du Bois hurt the cause? They're not the same cause. I know they're not the same causes.
For the short term, but look at what it led to down the line as far as the rise.
Which is what is why he did what he said and wrote what he did. That he knew that it would probably cause immediate trouble, and it did. And it's unfair. I'm going to start talking about lynchings and murders. And I think it's not fair to say that's Du Bois' fault. But there is an immediacy link that takes place there.
The backlash.
That's good. So even the thinking and the writing of the idea that maybe equality shouldn't be off in the distance, that rights of property and professionalism, rights in court should all be immediately here and now, that's what shakes white society in immediacy, especially combined with this upsurge of a new racist attitude that we're not guilty and wrong to be thinking superior here. But probably the factor, there's more about Du Bois I need to say here. He wrote three autobiographies, but The Soul of Black Folk, published in 1905, is the one that is the most drawn from to talk about his attitudes and thinkings. Yes? Off? I think not. I think we're like prisoners.
So we can have hot or cold air.
He, in 1905, organizes with a number of other progressive reformers what's called the Niagara Movement. It is an organization whose purpose is to try to bring about racial equality, not just nationally, but worldwide. So they hope to recruit kind of almost like an international relations organization for the sake of racial equality. By 1909, it evolves into the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored Persons, which is still in operation today. And he became numerous times president of the organization and publisher of the Oregon Journal up until his death in 1963. In fact, he died at age 95, one day before King gave his I Have a Dream speech in Washington. So he lived, 1868 to 1963. In the latter years of his life in the 20th century, especially after World War II, he became more and more disenchanted with capitalism, believed that capitalism was a barrier to racial equality. And in the American Communist Party, it had always been first and foremost in the early 20th century trying to help black civil rights well beyond any other organization. So it's not surprising that Du Bois would become first flirtatious with and eventually a member of the American Communist Party. And finally, so disgusted with the United States as well as being harassed during the Cold War, he moved to Ghana and stayed and never came back. So died in Ghana in 1963. But he becomes, it maybe in terms of writing and intellectual, not so much an activism, the most prominent, important African-American writer throughout the 20th century. And he gets his start way back at the turn of the century here, dealing with Jim Crow laws. Now, there's a name down here that really is not on your test and doesn't need to be pursued, other than just the fact that I find it interesting. This Herbert Apthecker is listed in item 12. This was a white historian who lived pretty much the same scope of time. He just died here back in 2003. I met him in 2001 at a Stanford summer class in which he was brought in as a speaker. He was already in his 80s then, and he spoke about what it was like to work directly with and under W. Du Bois, and he became eventually the executor of his papers and his research. And this guy was a hoot. I mean, this guy was really unbelievably wild. He come from well-to-do, wealthy family. He gave all that up to do work with Du Bois, and along with Du Bois probably laid the groundwork for most of African-American historical studies in the 20th century, became a member also of the American Communist Party at the worst time he could, probably in the 1940s. Well, actually, he was already a member in 39. Commanded a battalion of African American troops in World War II and held Nazis as prisoners after the war was over. Told all these stories when he was at Stanford. And he was one of those old, cranky, hardcore, leftist American commies like you always read about. I mean, he was just unabashed. And told the stories of what it was like to be harassed by the FBI. In fact, he said that the saddest part about the American Communist Party was that by the 1960s, two out of every three members of the party were FBI agents. And then he finally quit the party when the Soviet Union fell apart in 1991. Strange and interesting character. It was just, you know, all my life I heard about these old lefties from the pre-World War II period, and here was one of them who was close to Du Bois. But anyway, on with our story here. Item C of 9 now. This is the third cause for the Jim Crow laws and the loss of vote. And in my mind, I think this is the one that really had the greatest immediate impact. And that is the influence or the impact of the Populist Party to try to make a breakthrough in Southern politics. So we need to talk about Southern politics a bit and about the populists and why that's the case. As we recall, following Reconstruction, the Republican Party is gone. It was always a Northern-based and supported party more than anything, or that with black voters. So Democrats hold this monopoly over politics from 1877 to the 1960s. Well, this, in the 1890s, for a short period of time, there's the appearance of this third party movement called populists. And we're going to say a lot more about them later when we talk about farmer politics and the 1892 and 1896 presidential elections. But a quick glance at them now. These are Western farmers. The majority are from Kansas and Nebraska, the Dakotas, who believed in the end of the 19th century that both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, despite their claims of being for one community or another, you know, Democrats always bragged they were for the common man and blamed the Republicans as being for the wealthy. These farmers in the West argued they're both bought off by wealthy interests. They're, you know, Tweedledee and Tweedledum in politics. You can't tell them apart. And therefore, there needs to be a viable, serious third-party movement that represents the people's interests or the populists. So, hard to imagine at the end of a century people could feel that way about Democrats and Republicans. I think there needs to be a third party, but that's how they felt. And they were a mixture of avant-garde extremism as well as conservatism. They were anti-Semitic. They were in favor of private property for farmers. But they were for the equality of races and gender, and they were for the socialization, nationalization of industry and railroads and banks. So they were an odd mix. I guess what I'm getting at, we'll go over all these aspects a little bit later. What I'm getting at is, on the one hand, they're like futuristic socialists, and on the other hand, they're old-fashioned farmers and very conservative in their values. Racist against Jewish people, but for the equality of black and white people. And that's where it takes us into the South. That's where we need to know. Who are these populists in the South? Well, they're trying to build a national party. They're based in the West, but they're hoping to bring on Southern farmers, break this monopoly that the Democrats have in the South, and they also hope to gain the support of working-class factory people of the North. And neither will work. They'll never get in the factory owners' vote, and they'll never make it into the South. Their effect in the South, though, is to come in and try to tell poor white farmers and poor black farmers that you have a lot more in common as farmers, poor farmers, than you do different as races. What they're saying, in essence, is if you think along class lines, vote your pocketbook, not the color of your skin, you could win every election. But there's a lot more poor white and black farmers than there are rich plantation owners or factory owners. You could make the laws necessary to redistribute the wealth for your concerns. So this is a powerful message, the idea of uniting on the grounds of economic class lines rather than traditional race differences. If you're one of the Democratic bosses that's been easily elected time and time again by both black and white votes, and you see this populist threat coming in, and it's a time of Teutonic upsurge, and you hear that Du Bois' writings are making people uppity in attitude, what's your move here? And you're a bastard, too. I say that, too. Yeah, you purposely stir up racism. you go to the white farms and say, you may be poor, but you are white first and foremost, and you don't unite with lesser people. So you separate white voters away from black voters and try to keep them reminded to identify by race. And then with black voters, who might vote populist anyway, you just take their vote away. They're not going to be loyal voters in the Democratic Party. There's no need for their voting anymore. So that's why the vote is taken away, because of the populist threat that they're going to bleed black voters over to their side. And there's also some tactics listed in item 14 down here, such as poll tax and grandfather laws, and we'll get to those in a minute. Those will be instituted. But one of the worst long-range effects of this is not just immediate disfranchisement of votes. Oh, by the way, I'll only talk about Jim Crow laws before I go further. Jim Crow laws are instituted much for the same purpose. That if people are forced by law to be separate communities, you can do this in any experiment. Go into school and just tell everybody of one race they have to sit here, and tell everybody else another race they have to sit over there in the cafeteria for the day. And if they're young and impressionable, soon they're going to be asking why, right? What's got to be the only answer? But if they're troublesome enough to keep asking somebody is better than somebody. Somebody is not good to be with somebody else, that this group should not mix with this group. And, of course, the power base is going to figure they're the superior group. So the purpose of Jim Crow laws were to remind white people that they are superior to black people. They should not organize. They should not think along common cause lines of black people. And to remind black people that they are inferior. So that was the purpose of these laws. So what the populists have done, in a way, is kind of like what Du Bois has done, and they've triggered a backlash, which makes situations worse for the African-American community in the 1890s. Politicians, Democratic politicians, discovered that it wasn't just enough to eliminate the vote or identify whites with the Democratic Party. It was useful to run against fellow Democrats through purposeful race baiting. Race baiting meaning where you use race hatred to gain more support. So two candidates would get up and running for office. One would say, if you vote for me, I'll keep the black people in their place, and you'll be safe from their raids in the evening and things like that. And after he's finished, the next politician would say, don't listen to him, he's an end lover. He would give them the right to vote. He would give this, vote for me, I will do it twice as hard as he will. Well, it doesn't matter who gets elected in that setting. What has really won? And racism and hatred. That's what's really won. And so, while it was used to prevent populists from winning elections in the 1890s, it left a legacy of hatred, violence, lynching, and murder that lasted from the 1890s till the 1950s. That's where it comes from, this time period. Which is why I listed down here, number 13, the name Michael Richards. When I saw that, historically, I was really, really struck. Are we all familiar with what happened in that incident? A comedian from Seinfeld who was at a comedy club didn't know he was being taped on a telephone, and he was heckled by some people in the audience, and I guess they're African American. We don't see that, but he responds that way. It's not just a case of him responding back as a heckled comedian, but what is it that he said that was so super shocking? Yes, he did. He made a reference that there was a time in the past where you would be hanging in a tree stabbed with a fork. Now, that's not just a comic fighting back. That's not somebody trying to make a wisecrack. That is an immediate allusion to a time period when what was true? When just by race, your life could be endangered at any point in time if you spoke out of turn, and that there would be a legal system that would not protect you, but instead be on the side of watching you hang. And that was true. Lynchings were such that a lot of Southern sheriffs and legal officials either were involved in the hanging or stood back and let it watch and let families and children watch these things. I mean, it's an unbelievable, horrible legacy. And for someone to make that comment, when he made the remark that I just lost my temper, I don't know where that came from, we know where that came from. That came from a history of racism that our cultural legacy. So when people say that racism is gone today, it's kind of hard to believe when that's what can come out of somebody in anger. That was some of the most shocking, to me, comments made by anybody ever in public life. I mean, if it was somebody that's the average redneck nobody knows, that's a different story. But for someone of seeming prominence to reference that in anger shows us how entrenched this history was and still is. I don't think it's the same. I mean, I know that we hear...
I don't think that it's just white people that are racist.
Oh, I'm not saying that either, but can you tell me a time in American history when a white person had to be careful that they would be lynched and that all the legal system would be watching?
But I didn't do that. And I feel...
I'm not saying you have to feel guilty about it.
I don't. But I'm saying that sometimes, you know, people just assume that it's white people that are racist, and that's... I don't think that's true.
There's an argument to be made here, and I'm not a believer in it, so let's think about this one. Let's take it out of race and take it to gender. When men make remarks about a woman being worth barefoot and pregnant, that's highly sexist, and it's rude, and it's unforgivable, and it's not something that should be joked about, right? I mean, if I made that comment, I'd be fired. There's no doubt to that. In reverse, if women talk about a man who's really a useful man because he does the dishes and does the vacuuming, and if some kind of reverse comment was made about degrading a male, would it carry the same impact or punishment? It wouldn't. Why not? It's sexism both ways. It's because the history has been on the side of male domination and suppression. So yes, it is sexism and racism in both directions, but the history I'm trying to get across is which one carries the greater weight.
And I agree with that. I totally agree with that. And the parallel that you made there, both between the race and gender, is something that I think
That's right.
It's because of what the pastor said. It's like, oh, okay, well, she doesn't know what she's talking about. It's what?
Isn't it almost kind of accepted as, well, turnabout is fair play?
Well, but then it also goes to the thing, you know, the same discrimination, because it's always been in this world that if a woman, you know, is successful and is, you know, very self-assured and in control, that
she's called... She's called a bitch, and someone else is called ambitious.
Right.
Right. He's the man.
Right.
Doesn't it fit going back to race?
Yes, it does. And that's just it, where I'm not arguing with anybody, but even though no one generation now is responsible for what happened in the past, we can't. Our makeup, because of where we come from, and it's not that it's right; it's just the way that it is.
I think that's a good statement. Yeah, that's the way, and that's what I was trying to communicate: is that where power has been able to be applied to abuse, it carries a heavier legacy in history than where it did. And so I agree, yes, it comes back to the issue of like reparations for slaves. That's been an argument that's been existing for the descendants of slaves. That should there be a financial payoff to every descendant of a slave who was abused for free labor for so long. Maybe they parallel it to paying Japanese Americans who were put in prison camps in World War II, that they paid off the people. What's the difference there? Well, if they could find the actual people who did serve in the camps in 1985, when they paid off Japanese Americans, there was nobody left living, not even first offspring generations left living as a slave, so it's not practical or legal. That's the theme I was just trying to communicate, is the idea that where the power has been able to do more damage, that is where it's, I don't want to say more racist, more sexist, more, it's more hateful, it's more dangerous, I guess is the word I'm looking for. So I don't think we disagree.
I don't think it's right from either side.
Oh,
that's the point. But I'm
It does exist both ways.
I'm not saying that I don't understand where it comes from.
Let's see if I can find an example. If a male comedian made extremely rude sexist remarks about the abuse of a woman, that would probably fall close to the range of what Michael Richards said. If a female comedian got up and made a lot of remarks degrading men for the sake of sexual use and for domestic labor, etc., would she be so castigated that she's out of a job?
Well,
probably the reason that was possible and done was because there were so few. If there'd been as large as 11% of the population, like African Americans, it wouldn't have been considered. But when it was like less than 1% of the population. Well, that's true. I mean, well, I guess when, this is a wisecrack I shouldn't make, but when those illegal white aliens stepped on the shores back in 1619, maybe they should have been, you know, sent back where they come from. What occurred there?
You're sitting here now.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh yeah. It always does. It always does. But, and that's why I thought to myself, I'm starting a class on this issue. Well, what a stupid or gutsy move, but. But I think that's the importance of history. Is if it makes us do some soul searching and some thinking and over these issues, because this is a century and 120 years ago almost when all this happened. So it would seemingly be so far away from us, but it's really, that's why I put the Michael Richards thing there. It's not so far away from us. There's still legacy connections which make us have to understand why it's significant.
Then again, your point is the same. Isn't just between blacks and whites. Go back to Europe, you got the English that don't like the French, you got the Germans that don't like the Italians, and even in
and again, you have to apply who had the power over whom.
Don't like the Japanese.
Right.
And it has nothing to do with color or anything like that. As much as it has to do is...
It can have to do, not always, but it can have to do with color.
It's more of a... It seems like, in most places, the thing of, well, I'm this sort of people, and you're not that sort of people, therefore
I think a lot of it's, again, the power. Who has the power, who has the resources, who have the weaponry in order to keep a regime over someone else.
Because it's not just blacks that white people did this to. It was predominantly because they were the majority of the minority population. Yeah. But any time we had large numbers of Asian immigrants even European immigrants like...
Eastern Europeans or Irish. Yeah. What we're getting into is an interesting area where affirmative action programs have gone. Affirmative action originally was defended only for African Americans and no other minority, because the argument was that no other community had the experience of being enslaved. Even Native Americans were not enslaved. That there was discrimination and a lack of property, opportunities, etc. But as far as being fully stripped of the idea of being a human being and being totally property, that is unique to the black community. So the affirmative action was first argued as being something that should not be extended to all minorities because it dilutes the purpose and the history. But then politicians came to realize the more numbers you have involved in a policy, the more it gets passed, and so therefore other minorities were included. And correspondingly, it did dilute the reason and purpose. That's true. They were treated as a captured, conquered force, but never completely enslaved as property only.
It may
have been not much difference, but it was a difference.
But women were trading different crafts with them. So, I mean, they might as well have been. I mean, they had the worst.
Well, and you can also consider women in regards to even among Euro-American white people what the plight conditions were. So. Most indentured servants had a time period, 7-14 years. There was rarely ever indentured servitude for life, so it was kind of like graduate school. nothing now, but eventually it's supposed to be a payoff later. Okay, that I didn't mean to cheapen the circumstance of indentured servant. I apologize for that. Well, on with this. So this worked. I got people talking. Cool. Appreciate it. And you started, so thank you. Appreciate that. Without you, it may have never happened. So in 14, let's look at this. The Jim Crow laws and the way that the vote was lost, these were the tactics that were most commonly used to strip voting. Literacy tests, grandfather laws, and increased poll tests. Literacy tests were exactly as I said. You had to show proof of ability to read and write, as well as proof of understanding the politics of the elections. Yeah, I was going to say, would literacy tests be a good idea today?
Yes.
Yes, it would be, I think. Will it ever be? No, because it's just got the history that literacy tests were created, or at least promoted in this vein, in this venue, for the sole purpose of trying to weed out black voters.
Well,
in fact, the literacy tests weren't even fairly administered. They would say you'd have to explain the elastic clause portion of Article 1 of the Constitution if you're African American, and over here the white person signs the same these passes the test. But they weren't even fairly administered. But the whether they're culturally biased on purpose. That would be the difference. These literacy tests had the intent. So maybe a way to look at it is, if you had a family member executed through hanging, and someone brought what they thought was a nice little plant displayed with a little noose around it to your house for a gift, it might be an effective way to hang a plant, but it's never going to fly in that household. So similarly speaking, in the history of our nation, it's going to be a long time before literacy tests stand for something besides purposeful racism. That's the difference. But that's what its use was before. Grandfather laws, I think they were the most devious of all, and that is southern states qualify your voters. They would pass laws that said that if you had ascendant? A grandparent is an ascendant with an A. An ancestor, that's a lot better, yeah. You had an ancestor that could not vote before 1872, when the 15th Amendment was ratified, then all descendants, decessors? All descendants would also be barred from voting. So it said nothing about race. Again, we need to go back and look at the 15th Amendment. That if you had a relative that could not vote before 1872, before the 15th Amendment existed, and all descendants would also be correspondingly disenfranchised from voting. So it's family relations, not race, that's the issue. 15th Amendment says this: the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. So race, color, or slavery in the past cannot be affected. So far, with literacy tests and grandfather laws, has race, color, or previous condition of servitude been directly addressed in these laws? No. Yeah. So now we get into intent and wording of laws. The third tactic, the poll tax. Oh, this is all occurring in the 1890s. In fact, from the 1890s to the 1960s. Poll tax was a tax you paid to vote. States and could charge what they would wish on this, but in this case, they would up those poll tax extremely high, so not only did it disenfranchise most black voters because they were in the poorest economic situations, but a lot of your poor white farmers who might still be flirtatiously thinking populist, that would take care of them also. So are these tactics still doable? What's outlawed these? The literacy tests weren't outlawed until 1965 through the Voting Rights Act. They were approached in the 64 Civil Rights Act, but made stronger in the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And the court argued that that law is in harmony with the 15th Amendment. There is a direct link between literacy tests and racism by color, creed. So that's why I'm saying that literacy tests would be hard to... You'd have to have a court overturn that opinion and say that they no longer relate to racism. What about... This just went on in southern states. Occasionally western states did this. But they don't start moving in any sizable numbers until World War I when job opportunities exist, because this is not well stressed, but they weren't welcome in northern areas. Northern people were glad to see slavery over and glad to see African Americans remain in the South. So there was not the opportunities to buy property or move into northern areas until the 19-teens and 20s. So what about grandfather laws? Again, that's a case where the court argued the grandfather laws clearly violated the 15th Amendment in spirit. So these are 1960s court cases that overturned these. 1960s aren't that far away, right? Like 40 years? 50 years? Somewhere back there. But that's within, you know, my life, a lot of people's lives. That's the one that said that if you had a descendant that could not vote before 1872, before the 15th Amendment had guaranteed black voting, that all descendants were also banned. So like, say, for example, say it's Virginia, and you're in the county where Virgil Good is the representative. You may have heard about that recently. And you pass a law that says all people of Islamic faith and descendants of Islamic faith are forever banned from voting in Virginia. That's kind of what Virgil Good has been pushing for recently, kind of prevent Islamic people from moving into the state. Around that same idea. He's the one that got all mad about Keith Ellison. Keith Ellison's the Minnesota congressman that said he was going to take his oath on the Koran when he entered the House of Representatives. And Good argued that if someone was able to be sworn into Congress on the Koran, that would leave a dangerous opening for more and more foreign dangerous elements of Islamic people to move to America and disrupt our security and our civilization. Is he speaking from the heart, or is he just wanting to get reelected by his district? Both ways suck. Both ways horrifying. Third one, poll tax. Is that legal today? Nope. It's outlawed because of what? If I can remember even. 24th Amendment, 1961. No, 1963. So... what I'm getting at is these tactics used to prevent black voting were not overturned until just some 40, 50 years ago. So while what I'm trying to get across here is that we've been through quite a few generations of, since the Civil Rights Movement, we're in the third generation now, still the legacy is still there, and there are people still alive who wanted these things to exist. That's the thing I'm kind of stressed.
I have a question on the whole voting thing.
I never even thought about that you'd have to have separate polls. I guess I don't mean to be sarcastic, but since they're making sure there isn't going to be any black voting, they never had to go so far as to set separate polls. But it is a thought to pursue. I'll ask. I'll check. Technically speaking, to be legal, you would think they'd have to set up two election polls.
And would there have to be an African American person there, like, I don't know if they can, like someone to watch them vote? You know what I mean? Like, so.
Well, the practical reality is by the turn of the 20th century, black voting just stopped and did not occur in southern states again until the voting struggle in the 60s. Northern places, they did vote. Of course, there's no Jim Crow laws up there. So you're asking a question that legally that should be what we'd expect to happen, but practically speaking, what really occurred was the end of black voting, so there wasn't any force. But I'd like to pursue if there was ever any state that by sham tried to set up separate polls in order to keep the Washington off their back in the early days. They were thinking that. The Jim Crow laws, let's talk about them somewhat. They relate back to what we said in the introduction of the course when I mentioned that you don't have to know this for a test, but the 1875 Civil Rights Act, what did it provide for? Or what did it claim? Anybody write that down? Not the 1866 one, but the 1875 one, which is close to the end. Yes, yes, you could not deny equality in private businesses, like someone's restaurant or someone's hotel or something of that nature. And the 1883 Supreme Court case argued what? That the 14th Amendment only addressed state action, government action. Therefore, it violated people's property rights, the 1875 Act did. So what we're saying is after 1883, you could deny people equal services on the grounds that your property is your choice. You're all too young to remember this, but I can remember still in my young years seeing signs saying we reserve the right to refuse service to anyone, and those signs truly meant race, not just hippies. I mean, it was race is what I think behind that one. And the courts had established that. So the real question then would come to be, were Jim Crow laws, obviously Jim Crow laws were legal in a private setting. Were they legal in the public setting, like the voting arrangements she talked about? That's going to be challenged in the 1896 Plessy versus Ferguson case here in item 15, which is where we are. This is such a landmark case. This is close to the end of the period, so I can go ahead and make this wisecrack and you'll forget about it by the next time. But I think the three worst cases of injustice in Supreme Court history that I can think of is the Dred Scott case of 1857, Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, and Bush v. Gore in 2000. And that, not just because I'm a Democrat and wish Gore had won, but let me waste a little time on this case and explain why.
Can you bring
the
name of the first one, please?
Yes, Dred Scott, 1857. Which declared that African American people are not persons at all. They're clearly property, and that you cannot deny the right to own property anywhere in territories. And the Plessy case, which we will define in a minute. The reason I'm so bothered by the Bush v. Gore case is because the court said if you allow each county in Florida to count those votes the way they would wish, hold up to a light, looking for a hanging Chad, look for dimple Chad, etc. There is such an inconsistent pattern of vote counting that it denies the equality of those Bush voters who have already got the majority declared by Catherine Harris. If you allow that kind of unique recounting of all 60 counties to take place, and it switches that election around, that denies the equality of Florida voters. Then they turn around, according to the 14th Amendment. So it's the only case I know of where the 14th Amendment is used to justify a ruling on voting. Always before, that was left outside of the realm of the federal authority. Then they turn around and say, this case is not to ever be used as a precedent for any other future case. So no matter what the issue would have been, to completely defy the idea of the 15th Amendment and then turn around and say there is no precedent to be ever based on this case, does that even sound legal? I don't understand either. That's why when the first time I heard liberals, myself included, starting to claim they violated the law, let's impeach them, the judges, that's crazy talk. No, not really. But this case, we've got time for this case. The Plessy versus Ferguson case. I'll tell you the details of it and why it's significant here. Homer Adolph Plessy, an African-American citizen of Louisiana. He was 7/8 white, 1/8 black. Therefore, in the eyes of the law of Louisiana, he was, yes, it's the one drop of blood rule that was at work. And so therefore, as even though physical appearance, he passed for white easily, did business in white circles quite often as a result. They were supposed to, but he found it easy to travel about and do business in all communities that he did not. And it was one of these occasions where he was traveling from northern Louisiana back to his home parish, and someone from the home parish recognized him on the train. It's kind of like a Rosa Parks arrangement. And went to the conductor and said, this person may appear white, but he's actually black. He's Plessy. I know him, etc. He should be moved from one car back to the Jim Crow car. And when told to move, he refused and was arrested. And because of his connections in white circles, he was able to gain legal help and appeal to the federal court systems all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court ruling saw this outcome. One of the judges, named John Marshall Harlan, ruled that Jim Crow laws constituted an inherent inequality, that to separate by race creates inherent inequality. Eight of the other judges, the remaining judges, all argued instead, and that's what the majority opinion came out to be, what? Yes, as long as you had equal facilities provided, equal train cars, equal seats, equal restrooms, etc., to separate by race does not deny equality. Therefore, separate but equal became the doctrine that upheld the legality of Jim Crow laws from 1896 until when? 1954. John Marshall Harlan was the one dissenter in that case. And the reason I bring his name up is, I'll share it in a minute here. In 1954, what's the landmark Supreme Court case that Earl Warren presided over? Brown versus the Board of Topeka, Kansas Education, in which the nine judges all completely, including grandson of John Marshall Harlan, John Marshall Harlan Jr., was on that court in the 1950s. All nine judges, urged by the new Chief Justice Earl Warren, reversed the Plessy case, saying exactly what the grandfather had said, that separation by race creates inherent inequality. Now I want to go back and talk about the Jim Crow laws for a second. Why were they enacted? To stir up inequality among the races. So the purpose we know, the historic purpose behind these laws was inequality. So how does a Supreme Court of seeming learned jurists in 1896 come to a conclusion that as long as there are equal facilities provided, you haven't created inequality? Are they hardcore racists? I'm not even sure they were necessarily raised that racist. I think it's a court that knew that they didn't have the resources or the will to force southern states to follow the law. That this had come to be, the Civil War and Reconstruction is over. This is not a war to be refought. We're a nation based on state law, state sovereignty, and they just didn't want to get into trying to force social equality on the southern states in 1896. And another argument is that a court in the 1870s, still fresh from the Civil War, may have ruled differently. But by the 1880s and 1890s, the federal court's major focus was on protecting property rights and business, not racial equality. So that's those are landmark cases. Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, not reversed until 1954. And even in 54, it's not a full reversal. The Brown case only outlawed segregation in public education. It would be subsequent court cases and civil rights laws from the 50s into the 60s that move it over outside of education into private, like hotels and businesses, etc. So that's what I was really trying to say, is that this may seem to be about race relations in the 1880s and 1890s, but it sets the vector and the process into place that lasts throughout all of the 20th century up until the 1950s and 60s. Yes?
If you're saying that the Supreme Court are more concerned with property rights and stuff like that, or even if you say that they just didn't want to ruffle the feathers in the South, why they even taking them to the court?
That's a good point. Lots of I think to prevent future cases coming, because there had been some subsequent cases in the 1880s addressing that issue. There would be cases also dealing with Chinese Americans and Japanese Americans, and I think by Plessy gave them a precedent to work from so that in all future situations they don't have to take the case. Not their proudest moment, but it's an important piece of history. And again, we're real close to leaving now, so even more controversial things that we've forgotten, as I said. It's not the idea of ruling the way they did reminds me somewhat of, it's not the same thing, but somewhat of the Michael Newdow circumstance. Are you familiar with Michael Newdow? Californian atheist whose daughter was compelled to listen to the Pledge of Allegiance. He complained that since it has the under God phrase in it, that it turns it into a prayer. So he fought in the federal courts to have the Pledge of Allegiance outlawed or changed in wording if it's going to be compulsory exposure in public schools. Not that somebody has to do it, but you even have to listen to it. And he won a successful victory in 2002 in the Ninth Circuit Court in California. Then the court reversed itself, so he resued, appealed it to the Supreme Court. What was the Supreme Court's ruling on this? Interesting ruling. Did they say the pledge must be overturned? Or did they say, no, the pledge is legal? That's it. They said, since the daughter is living with the mother, Michael Newdow, the father, doesn't have custody of the daughter and therefore doesn't have the authority to sue, we won't therefore have to address any further defects. There's a court with some anatomy for you. See you next time. We could have a quiz, but we just don't have enough yet. Let's get some more material so we've got lots of extra bonuses. Since the Russians were atheists.
Yeah.
Very true. Thank you. Thank you for your participation. Thank you for saying what you did.
Well, I think it might have set some people off. I mean, at my point,
I don't want to say those things, but I can't say both things.
Well, where I was coming from on that, though, is that, you know, the focus is on
us. I'm concerned about white guilt all the time.
You already did.
That's why I made the comments about affirmative action. Affirmative action has been milked and used and misused.
And it is. And ultimately, I feel like in this day and age, a lot of minorities are really able to
ratify. I'd say generally more so. Because the reason I say that is the lower the income and the lower the education level, regardless of race, the more likelihood for shallow provincialism.
Ignorance.
So the people who are the most still denied opportunity are likely to be the most ignorant. I agree.
And they are. And I agree with you. I mean, there are so many measures set up to take them and give them extra rights, in my opinion, extra opportunities, even above us.
But see, I'm saying, there's where you can take race out of the issue and say even people of lower income, white background, have so many opportunities that are never used or taken.
Yeah, they do. I agree.
It's very class.
Well,
so, but
I can help you.
Well, thank you, because without it, there would have been no discussion. I'd just been up here preaching.
Well, you know, I don't think that it's what probably the majority of the class wanted to hear, and I think that's what my comment made it wrong, but that's the way I feel about it. You know,
a lot of people feel like you do. They just didn't know.
All the focus is on us.